Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. I know you didn't think I would make it back. What she's referring to, ladies and gentlemen, I was at the annual meeting of the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences, where literally thousands of people show up from not only the United States, but around the world, and present papers and serve on panels and have discussions about every kind of object or subject you can think of in the criminal justice field. And this year it was in Cincinnati, not very far away, so I drove, and Audrey was thinking that maybe I would not make it back. Now, Mike, I know what you're going to say, that if had it been on St. Paddy's Day, which is Monday, maybe I would have taken an extra day, but I cut it short. I only stayed 2 of the 4 days in order to get back and do some work at my day job. And anyway, it was a very enjoyable experience. Met lots of folks that you probably only see about once a year, but talk with and converse and sometimes write with. And my subject this year was the radio show. Yes, the Blog Talk Radio Show, Jumble Justice, that you're listening to right now. And maybe perhaps I'll have some time later on to comment about that. But it was a very enjoyable experience. And my old department down there at the University of Cincinnati did a superb job of hosting this conference, and I like, they serve Starbucks coffee all over the place, so you can't beat that. How do you like that song that Johnny Cash sings? I even referred to that in my presentation. Ladies and gentlemen, that's 90 cities and states plus. Sometime dig out the lyrics to that song and see if you can sing it yourself. But everybody's back in the booth tonight, or back in the showroom, and we're set to go. Emily and Mike, good to see you there. And Audrey, again, thank you much for getting us on. And there is this little, it's not odd, it's normal. If I look on the switchboard, I see my phone numbers up there again. Remember last week, I didn't think I was on, so I got off and came back on and never did show up, but the show did broadcast fine. But tonight, my number's back up there, and so everything's perfect. So, ladies and gentlemen, what we do in this show is our purpose is to discuss all kinds of events, news issues, any kinds of developments that happen in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And our show is dedicated to those tireless police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals throughout the world. And I guess I released a secret today at the presentation when I was discussing the paper. The paper's 25 pages. If you want to write in, send me an email. I'll be glad to send it to you. It had four tables in it and some data about our shows and some analysis of the type of topics we've had by category and that type of. It's always good to do that kind of work to see see what really happened over the past 71 shows. That paper covers 71 shows through February. But anyway, it was interesting to find out. And of course, our guest tonight was, as I mentioned that in the presentation, that we were going to be talking about the homeless again with Professor Michael Lewis. Someone right in the audience out loud said, what an interesting topic. And I was very pleased. We had some people there that I know, of course, in the audience, and they were pleased to see that too. But anyway, I told them, back to the secret, that what I really want to do with the show is take like the best 2025, and certainly the presentations on the homeless would be one of those, and turn it into an audio book, and probably call it Criminal Justice Heroes and Heroines. And we'll have things on there like Professor Lewis and Dr. Collins and his work with the deaf and the criminal justice system, and you know, some of the others that were in the Strange But Real book that we did last year. They would be suitable folks. And we'd also like to include police women in Bahrain and some of these other interesting topics. We've had people from all over the place. And I was noticing at the book exhibit at the conference, there are always all the major publishers there, and they're all displaying their books and giving some away, but letting you take orders, and they'll send you free copies. It's a marvelous experience to walk around as opposed to just looking on a website and see all of these books. But it was really a fascinating experience. But my prediction was, and I said it out loud, that probably in 4 or 5 years, I don't think we're going to be seeing all these hard copy books. You know, I have my Sony Reader, and the Kindle is now out. That's manufactured by Amazon. The Kindle holds 200 books. You can download a book from anywhere in the United States without having a computer. Write down on that Kindle. The Kindle also takes notes. You think, well, that's $400, but when you look at the price of the books, you're getting digital form books probably like bestsellers a third or at least a half of the price. So these textbooks are up over. I've got one now that's my name on it that's selling for maybe $115, $120, and that's really pushing the limit. One of the things I noticed at all the exhibits, the book covers are getting bigger. So I asked some of the salespeople and some of the other staff that were from the big publishing companies, and they said that's just to push the book. They're trying to make it bigger so you see it. It's kind of like a billboard. I guess a bigger billboard is easier to see than a small one. But anyway, that's a very marvelous part of the exhibit. What we tried to do in this show is look inside of this criminal justice field and criminal justice practice, and we enjoy doing that every week. I always mention also, I mentioned it to our audience at my presentation today, that it is possible that you can do it. Alan Levy is the genius that gave us this medium, and you can have your own show broadcast worldwide and streaming audio to an unlimited number of listeners, and the cost is absolutely free. I usually say that again. I won't tonight for the sake of time, but it is really something, and I'm surprised that nobody in the room other than the folks that I knew had even heard of Blog Talk Radio. And this is where 66,000 shows are now archived, and many of these shows are hosted by very famous, well-known politicians, writers, entertainers on that site. So if you haven't browsed around Blog Talk Radio, you go ahead and do it. If you don't mind, ladies and gentlemen, I think what I'm going to do is click on Professor Michael Lewis right now and see how he's doing. Michael, are you there?
I am. Good evening, Professor Haley. How are you?
Good. How are you doing? Great. Talk to folks down in Cincinnati that knew you, and talk to some folks from Walden, actually.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Walden University, and that's a very prominent name around the circles now, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yes, it is.
Right. Very good place, and I've encouraged a couple people to seek their doctorates there, and maybe they'll be buzzing you and getting some advice on how to do that. But it was a good meeting, and wish you could have been there. But I hate running away in the middle of these things. But you know, when you're teaching some classes online and you got business and advising week and all that, I feel like I never had a spare minute. Actually,
I understand.
I spent a lot of time on the cell phone, and I usually don't do that when I'm talking to people. But you know, it kept ringing, so you have to answer. It's easier than taking messages, but that's very good. Well, folks, if anybody else wants to call in tonight and ask Professor Lewis some questions, you can call in. If you're looking on the computer, you probably already know, but it's 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. And I mentioned also today, and people are writing this down, that you know, when I mentioned shows like yours, Michael, and some of these other folks, boy, they said, what a way, somebody shouted out in the class, I mean the presentation again, what a way to use some class time with some good things, you know. They said fill up the class, but I didn't want to tell them, look, we're not really just trying to fill up the class. But I think some of these people are going to use our show now for like a substitute teacher once in a while.
I know I have, absolutely.
Audrey has collected a blonde joke tonight. It's about, this was passed on by one of her friends named Jane, and this one is kind of a border security joke. Would you care to hear this one, Mike?
Sure.
Okay, let's see what she's got here. You got that thing all tuned up, Audrey? Okay, here we go.
Professor Haley, since you have been to the border to study the illegal immigration issue, I thought you might like this blonde joke. Emily and Mike approve and laughed hard, so it must be a good one. I understand and came from a friend named Jane. Here it is. Two illegal Mexican immigrants are on a bike along US 52 about 15 miles outside of Lafayette, Louisiana. One of the bike's tires goes flat, and they start hitching a lift back into town. A friendly trucker stops to see if he can help, and the Mexicans ask him for a ride. He tells them he has no room in the trailer as he is carrying 20,000 bowling balls. The Mexican illegals put it to the driver that if they can manage to fit into the back with their bike, will he take them back into town, and he agrees. They manage to squeeze themselves and their bike into the back, and the driver shuts the doors and gets on his way. By this time he is really late, and so puts the hammer down. Sure enough, a blonde cop pulls him over for speeding. The good officer asks the driver what he's carrying, to which the driver jokingly replies, Mexican eggs. The cop obviously doesn't believe this, so wants to take a look in the trailer, and opens the back door, then quickly shuts it and locks it. She gets on her radio and calls for immediate backup from as many officers as possible plus the SWAT team. The dispatcher asks what emergency she has that requires so many officers. I've got a tractor trailer stocked with 20,000 Mexican eggs in it. Two have hatched, and they've managed to steal a bicycle already.
Well, that's an. I hope people take that joke the right way. That's an interesting one. Imagine carrying 21,000 bowling balls, but I imagine one of those trucks would probably do that. Do you ever bowl, Michael?
Once in a while, sure. Yes.
I always hated a sport where I don't want to have this perceived as being sexist, but where a pregnant woman could beat me.
True.
I don't think I ever rolled over 100. I can never understand scorekeeping. So.
All done electronically now, so it's easier. So.
But it's a great sport. I know a lot of people enjoy playing it. If you don't mind, we're also going to do this service that we do every week to the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. And they're trying to get the people off the street who are carrying firearms. And I think once they hear this, announcement, I'm sure each week they go and turn in their pistols and guns to. Ohio Coalition here. We'll go ahead and play there.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
I had dinner last night with some friends, and one of them was a prominent sheriff here in the state of Ohio, and he was asking him how many gun permits he had issued, and he had said, as many as I can. That was my kind of guy. We had a little trouble with some folks walking around the skyline down there. It was really kind of lack of security, and there were some, they kind of perceived to be gangbanger types that were sort of bothering people. And, you know, I thought that should have been better policed, but it wasn't. A lot of Cincinnati's businesses moved over the river, yet the downtown is really lovely. You get downtown Cincinnati much?
I did. You know, in the fall, I with a partnership with Cincinnati State College down there, so I had some time, several weeks down there. It was a very nice area, and I stayed over in, I think it was called Newport, Kentucky, just on the side of the river. So very nice.
Very nice area. It certainly is. well, a couple news items I had tonight. I was going to sort of focus on, I thought you might enjoy this, just sort of a lighter side of the news tonight before we get into your subject. I can't believe that some of the things that go on in our public schools. And one of the things here that a Minnesota lawmaker is recommending, he's saying that body sprays and any type of aftershave lotion or cologne or whatever that young men might wear in school when they're in the 5th, 6th grade, 8th grade, something like that. I guess maybe, you know, after some of them start shaving in the 9th or 10th grade, they might put on some aftershave. This Minnesota lawmaker, he's going to ban that, make it against the law to wear these harmful scents. Can you believe that?
Well, it could be distracting maybe in school, I would suppose. That's the point.
Pardon?
It could be distracting, I suppose. That could be argument for it, but never heard of that, though.
Given some of the styles now, you know, I guess grunge is out, but there's a new form of it. I think not washing your clothes is distracting, too. I'd rather smell the sprays than something else. But, you know, soap even has a scent to it. So I can't imagine how they're going to do something like that and force it. But I suggest that's probably not going to go very far. The Chanel No. 5 lobby is probably pretty strong, right?
We'll see how that shakes on court, I think, yeah.
here's another one where a young man in school, he came to school with a T-shirt on that has an image of a gun. Have you heard about this one?
No, I didn't.
And he was disciplined and fell from school, and the shirt has this gun on it, and on the front pocket it says Volunteer Homeland Security. On the back is Special Issue Resident Lifetime License, United States Terrorist Hunting Permit.
Okay.
Number like 91101, gun owner, no bag limit, it says on the shirt. But anyway, officials in Minnesota told him to take off a shirt. He refused to do it, so he got 2 days of detention. Now what's happening is his parents are actually suing the school system.
Okay.
Or something like that. I'm getting to think that maybe, you know, we all have friends that are administrators and teachers in the public schools, but are they sort of losing their sense of humor?
Sounds like it.
Anyway, that's another school one, and I think there's one more here. Another kid got getting thrown out of school for selling candy.
Okay.
Schools for some type of, here it is. He's selling Skittles inside the school, and it's called contraband.
Okay.
Do that. So Superintendent Reginald Mayo said in a statement that he and Principal Eleanor Turner met with his parents, and they've decided to clear the boy's record finally and restore him to his student council post. They actually took him off of student council. There's a picture of him here. It looks Michael Sheridan. Looks like a nice young man, but he happened to be selling these Skittles for some type of cause. I don't know what a Skittle is. What is that?
Yeah, some type of candy.
Is it? Okay. But anyway, he they restored him back to his position as student council president. But my Lord, I guess they're doing all that stuff. I guess they don't have much time for reading and studying, do they?
Right. Nobody wants to get convicted of Skittle peddling, I guess. So
what a record to have. And finally, here, have you heard about the new British camera? That the Brits, you know, love this camera stuff. They've got one now. I might have briefly referred to it last week, but this camera actually sees through clothing.
Yes, I did hear that. Amazing.
but not very far. It won't go all the way through your clothing. It'll just detect objects and something like that. You know, but that would be really great for detecting things like that. A friend of mine sent me, he might have sent it to you too, since he's on our faculty, but he sent me a little picture of a guy, and the caption was, "Why cops sometimes shoot people with knives."
Oh, okay.
And this guy was sliced from literally all the way across his upper body. I mean, gashes that I could not even believe. I'll send that to you if you haven't seen it. And a lot of people say, you know, when you see somebody with a knife, I probably said it myself, why can't you just, you know, step out of the way or something? Why do you have to shoot him and kill him? But this might be one reason.
Right.
I actually lived. But the gaps are just incredible. And that the folks that I had on once, the radio show about a year ago, who were in that, who formed that group called Citizens for Lawful Communities, their son was killed by six or seven illegal Mexican immigrants, and they all had knives.
Okay.
And knife can take a part of you, can it?
It can, absolutely. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, Michael, let's go get into the homeless, if you don't mind. And for the folks that have just been joining the first time, and I think some people maybe from the conference might be listening in tonight because they were really interested in your topic. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you happened to get turned on to this topic?
Absolutely. It certainly is a pleasure to be a guest again on your show. I certainly appreciate this opportunity. And I'm kind of in a unique position because I'm both a professor and also a student. I'm finishing my dissertation for a PhD. And my concentration here, it's not only on police services, but all on the homeless, but also some additional, some strategies to possibly reduce, you know, chronic homelessness within our communities. As a veteran law enforcement officer, I just retired here in this past July to take up academics in higher education here on a full-time basis. So with my law enforcement background and the educational background, it was one of those things that I've always kind of had an interest in and certainly have had contacts in as a police officer. And it was one of those gaps that always there was a void there, it seemed like, within policy, within dealing with some of the less fortunate. So it's something that always was in the back of my mind as far as looking into and possibly researching. And you know, now I have the vehicle to do it through my dissertation. So,
I ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone actually written a book on this? Is there a book?
You know, there are a few dissertations out there. There's some research. But what I've found really is a lot of some basic and some grassroots type of developments from communities as far as getting things published and going out and actually doing things. But there's not much literature out there, and it's one of those things that people want to address.
I couldn't go to Amazon.com and find a book on police and the homeless?
You're not going to find many, no. There's not a whole lot out there.
What an opportunity.
Yes, right, absolutely.
Waiting on yours. Go ahead, I heard you.
Yes, Ed, well, that's something down the road I think I'm going to certainly endeavor in. But, you know, I think as a police officer, and just to give you a little bit of the background as to kind of why I'm really interested in this research, but, you know, as a police officer, especially in the late 1980s and 1990s, you know, we really had very limited resources and some options when dealing with the homeless population. I think kind of as a police officer, we more or less only dealt with the criminalization issues, you know, such as arresting them or ticketing them instead of offering other options or alternatives. That seemed to be the fix or the Band-Aid approach in law enforcement. Nobody really wanted to stand up and work collaboratively with other agencies or with their cities to, you know, to address the problem and the issues that, you know, are on all of our city streets. But, you know, I kind of viewed arresting the homeless for, say, sleeping in vacant buildings or in doorways almost more of a burden, not only to the police department, you know, but kind of to our community as well.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly arrested, you know, a lot of homeless people, and it certainly was a challenge. I think because, for one, it took us off the streets. You know, and having to really either take them to the hospital because of poor hygiene or because they were ill and didn't have any health care for a long time, or just, you know, staying in jail for a long time with them. It really, in my opinion, from an administrative point of view, is kind of a poor allocation of resources, really, if you think about it. You know, instead of offering other units or other type of options in dealing with it on the street as far as just processing them. System, the court system.
What are probably two or three most prominent calls where you run in? I assume with your own proactive type of patrol, you run into them yourself. But when you get called on them, they're called in what? Sleeping in a doorway, or ill on the street, or what type of calls do the cops get relative to them?
Yeah, a lot of that would be just kind of loitering after, you know, in the parks and vacant buildings. Then also for panhandling. I think that's something that's almost a separate issue because they get lumped into that. So I think just, you know, panhandling at events in the city and you know, sleeping on the doorsteps and things like that. It's more of a kind of a public nuisance type of, you know, crime. So that's something that, you know, as a police officer, I used to get called, you know, quite a bit, you know, to go investigate and to go handle.
Is that, those type of calls, is that when you worked with the Metropolitan Housing Authority?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What size community was that you worked with?
That community was roughly right around 50,000 people. It's more or less the you know, the inner city and the projects in the greater Cleveland area.
Big population.
It was a very big population. I just think if we had other options or alternatives, you know, such as outreach units or some safe houses or some other progressive plans, I think we really could have devoted more time to patrolling and doing a better job in arresting really the bad guys out there that sometimes were, you know, were left roaming the streets while we were tied up doing other things. So,
did you find many people as interested in it as you are?
No, not really. I think one of the main driving forces behind my research and my passion here is, you know, years ago we had arrested an elderly man that was homeless for years, and he was a veteran, and he was in a vacant unit, and he was eating a dead cat. And I remember thinking, boy, I wish somebody could do something about him, and we ended up having to arrest him, you know, and I gave him, I think, $5 just to say, you know, here's, you know, after you get out of jail, go get something to eat. Well, now I feel all these years later I can do something, and hopefully can have some type of add some value or some type of positive impact, you know, with law enforcement and within the homeless population.
Mm-hmm. That's a sad story, isn't it?
Certainly is.
Speaking of that.
Yeah, that's something else.
Makes me think of a wild story I just saw the headline for today, maybe a paragraph about it, but some, I think, was in Arizona where they found 800 cats in one house trailer.
Oh, really? Okay.
800 cats in one house trailer.
That's a lot of cats.
I think were pups. That's what it was. Yeah, and they said that most of them were in good health.
Is that right? Okay.
Unbelievable. I think they charged somebody with something in that regard. But, that's interesting. And I suppose that people are caught up in so many things, busy and working jobs, and social services have already obligated their funds for all sorts of things. I imagine somebody's doing something, but it's certainly not enough because they're still on the street and they still need care, don't they?
Right, yes. Well, I think from my life experiences and my research, it really opened my eyes not only to this social issue, but other social problems that you really and issues as well that sometimes kind of plague, our society. My research has fortunately taken me to several different cities to study, you know, and obtain data regarding homelessness and some of the services in America that services are provided. That at least in you know, my area, in the Northeast Ohio area, really, there are some programs obviously and some good services and certainly some good dedicated people out there that are working working diligently to come up with some good solutions. But I think by going to other areas, I've been able to really find some good sources, some good resources to hopefully drive what I'm doing here.
You shop to find in the warmer climates substantially more people. I mean, is that true? It probably is, isn't it?
It is. I've talked to several homeless people in the past few years with compiling my research, and usually in the early fall they start to kind of, if they have the resources to either hitchhiking or walking or whatever, is try to migrate down south to the warmer climate. That is, and it certainly then becomes a burden to the to the southern communities because of the influx of people roaming the streets. But that's a good point.
You the ones that are, there are some that are mobile, I guess. In fact, I think Congressman Kucinich, wasn't he homeless at one time?
Yeah, I think he was back in the 70s, yes. Mm-hmm.
Some live in their car, is that correct?
They do, absolutely, yes. I think the majority of those who live in the car are kind of, they're not the chronic homeless people. Chronic homelessness really is defined of a few episodes within a three-year time span as far as being homeless, or for being on the street for 1 year or longer. So most of the people that are mobile, there may be homeless for short periods of time and do have other support services or do take advantage of support services, as opposed to the more chronic homeless people.
I think we talked before about, at least a little bit, about how some of these colleges and universities that are, essentially open campuses, that there are places where, the big, particularly where the homeless reside. I imagine Ohio State probably has a chair, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
Are there some in Cleveland State, too, that they know of?
There is. There's always some problems around that campus just because it's, the proximity and right downtown, so yes. Mm.
Hmm. Well, what did you find with I think you've made, two trips to Dallas?
Yes.
What was the nature of this trip? What was going on there?
This trip was to do some follow-up from some of the things that I did last year and just to obtain some more data. So I went to Dallas, and I also was able to go to the city of Hillsboro and also Waco, which is about an hour and a half, 2 hours, from the city of Dallas. And
Waco, very well.
And to speak, to some of their people within the police department and social services entities as well. But I think it's probably the most progressive, really, city that I've had contact with was the city of Dallas. I've been there on several occasions, and I participated in various workshops and initiatives there. Now, last year, I participated in a citywide homeless headcount initiative that was orchestrated by the Homeless Outreach Unit. Now, that's a real good unit. The leaders there are two gentlemen, name of Ron Coberts and Dave Hogan. They really do a nice job. Their hearts are certainly in the right place. They work very collaboratively with various other city departments, such as the police, crisis intervention units, social services, and they really work with just a myriad of volunteers and advocates to assist them in their daily activities. Now, this is a full-time unit that the city of Dallas has dedicated towards reducing, chronic homelessness within their city. So headcount, basically what that is, it's described as a point in time, like a snapshot initiative that looks at kind of who's homeless, why they're homeless, and then how society can help them end their homelessness. Kind of a neat concept. Essentially what we did as far as going out and part of this initiative, we took a therapeutic approach and conducted structured interviews with the homeless, asked them structured questions on, how we can help, what services they needed, different things of that nature.
What did they say?
Well, you know, it's funny. Almost everybody wanted to talk, and it wasn't so much that they wanted free things or they wanted an open hand offerings, but it was that they were. I think that's one of the things that a lot of people don't understand, or it's one of the things that really hit home to me is the human element. You know, these are people that have been kind of taken out of society for whatever reason, but are still people, you know, and it's just, I guess it kind of depends on their circumstances. You know, but the information that we received from this data was kind of age, sex, health issues, you know, veteran status, substance dependency, and different things like that. But, you know, like I said, I think that's the most important thing that kind of hit me was, you know, these are people, you know, and they're just kind of down on their luck. And a lot of them just, you know, are in that transition period. In the meantime, they don't know where to look for support services, or they don't know where to go. So that was a nice thing with certainly with Dallas and actually these other in the city of Waco as well. They do very good as far as taking a good approach and reaching out to them and offering them services or at least options on where to go and how to help themselves.
Does a major transportation route there, I'm thinking of Route 35 from Dallas down to Waco, does that have something to do with it in terms of where they gather? And
Actually, yeah, it does. I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that you know, Dallas is such a growing area that it attracts a lot of people, including the homeless people. Now, the main highway to Dallas is Interstate 35, and that's the major north and south interstate in Texas, and for the whole central United States, really. It runs, I think, from, is it Laredo, Texas, at the Texas-Mexican border, all the way to the Minnesota-Canadian border. You know, and certainly because of that fact, there's a lot of traffic up and down 35. So, yeah, that seems to be the kind of the main route, and you know, that's always just a busy, very busy area.
Does Waco have, you know, well, there's a lot of colleges there. There's probably five colleges, universities around there, Baylor being the largest. Do some of them reside in around the Baylor campus, too?
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some outreach, there's some areas, city, and then it kind of gets into rural area, and it was pretty interesting kind of to see the mix of people dispersed through Waco. There's certainly a lot of land space there. Yes,
that is really interesting. What do you get to know? Are there some celebrated characters like in Dallas where, you know, they've been there for a long time and the cops know them and the social service people know them?
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. They like you said, the outreach program, it's a full-time unit. They go out, you know, really on a daily basis, and they respond to the needs, or they respond to even citizen complaints of homeless people. So they go out every day, and they have contact with them. I was able, fortunate enough, to go out with them and ride with them and speak to a lot of the homeless people for my research before we got off count. But one gentleman particularly stuck out in my mind. He was underneath this bridge for 15 years, and he was kind of like the mayor of this cardboard box. There's probably about 100 of them, to be honest with you. And they policed their own area. They were all in little cardboard boxes and little makeshift houses. He was kind of the mayor of that little area, and it was so tucked away you'd never see it from the street. You know, it was a hard place to get to, but he was pretty. There's definitely a hierarchy, and he was pretty much the chief there. It was pretty interesting.
I wonder how you get to be the chief.
I guess just by longevity, I guess. I don't know. I think I wanted to point out that, talking with the homeless, or just like doing this headcount initiative, it's all voluntary. Now, none of the homeless people have to provide any information or anything. You know, but like I said, most of them, were all very approachable, and everybody did want to talk and be helpful to us.
I think other than you, probably the rest of us don't know really how close we are to that, do we? People don't, they think, well, these are people that have been this way all their life and all that, and I think certainly, and I've read about some, that, you know,
we may only be a couple steps away from it. You lose a job, lose a house, and...
But you're right. Yes, it is. It is. It's unbelievable. You know, I talked with I guess it's very difficult to kind of pinpoint or really categorize the specifics. But it appears to me that there's really a multitude or kind of a lifetime of problems and issues that really substantially contribute to homelessness. But sometimes it could be just the fact that I talked to people that had decent jobs that were laid off or that were fired, and then, you know, they had no other services. But, you know, the one man I talked to, the encounter, he and it's one of those things that seems like, unfortunately, it's also a common thing that he was abused as a child and had difficulties, you know, through adolescence. I all too often, you know, we see that in criminal justice. And, you know, this seems to be the kind of the igniter for trouble in the future, too, you know.
Wouldn't that have been interesting if we thought of doing the show while you were there on the spot?
Yeah, that would have been good. Yeah.
Guys, and what are the women like in terms of what are the differences in their plight, so to speak?
I talked to a lot of women, most of which are, you know, are very dependent, or not very independent, I should say. I'm sorry, that were married, had abusive relationships. And most of the women seemed like they were older, 40s, 50s, 60s. I mean, it was an older, that kind of had, problems, and that was the last resort, and they really had nowhere to go. So it was one of those that none of them seemed, that were younger that kind of hit the streets right away and were homeless. I think the women that were, trying to persevere a bad relationship or trying to, you know, stay within their communities and stuff that just ended up in the streets. But they're very, very strong-willed, certainly very strong-willed ladies.
Can I imagine, are there couples? I mean, they pair up and...
There are some that, they're married. Not too many, but we did see a few. Surprisingly, there's enough... youth that are under 18, and what the city does with them, they take them into custody and go from there. There are some families out there, and I guess as long as they are legitimately families, then the city really hasn't done anything. I think with them as far as taking them off the streets or whatever, but certainly they offer the services to get hopefully a head over their roof over their heads here and try to get them on their feet.
I think I mentioned to you the last time I had run the Dallas Marathon three or four times, and I always got there early downtown.
Oh,
and I was astounded to see the people sleeping in the doorways and families with children.
Right.
The numbers just astounded me. I couldn't believe it.
Yes,
and then
right.
I was down there when the World Soccer Tournament was going on. That's when Dallas was having the big push to get them off the street.
Yeah,
and
right. They
got them somewhere. I don't know where they took them. Did they ever tell you that?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a good secret. But I think they were taken care of, and they eventually found their way back. I think in the city there's roughly like 3,000 to 5,000, something like that, the homeless people, they say, on any given night. Just to give also some an idea of what some of the progressive cities are doing, like Dallas is, you know, there's funds that communities can receive. I mean, there's millions of dollars in grants, you know, that are out there to combat, homelessness. And HUD, Housing and Urban Development have grants that it really provides some pretty decent resources. And part of this headcount initiative is through the HUD program, and they require cities and counties to do a street count, a head count every year, to hopefully ascertain kind of an accurate count of, homeless people in the community. And it's always done in the winter months, like in January, just because a lot of the people are taking advantage then of shelters and different things of that nature, so they can be, readily accounted for.
You know, here's an idea for you. I'll bet
that there's no university that's ever gotten one of those grants to a criminal justice school to study the homeless and work with the homeless. Wouldn't that be an interesting center?
No, that would be. That absolutely would be. You know, years ago, at Nels Anderson from, I think he was the University of Chicago, he was a one-time hobo, you know, back in the 20s. Now, he ended up receiving his PhD and became a professor. And, you know, way back then, they did some research, some federally funded. Never heard of anything like that, really, at all. So that would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I was also thinking, I don't follow movies too much anymore, but if Hollywood or somebody got behind, you know, documentaries don't go over, but wouldn't that be interesting to take some of these characters or to have people play those roles and actually, you know, do a movie about the homeless and their plight and family? I think that would probably generate a lot of interest among the American people. What do you see there in terms of ethnicity? Is there any, I mean, Dallas is a big international type city. Is the homeless population represented by different ethnicities, or pretty much black and white?
It is. You know, there's a good mix of people, but it seems like the majority were probably black males, probably in their, you know, older in their 40s or 50s or even 60s. I think the oldest gentleman I talked to was either early 80s or just turned 80. He was in good, you know, pretty good health, really. But
for a long time.
And there's also quite a few of the illegal, you know, Mexicans that the immigrants that there are in now that you know that are doing the day labor work and different things like that, and their homes are really under a bridge. And you know, I spoke with numerous, you know, of those people, and they're basically said they're making more money than they could here, and they'll live, you know, like this, as opposed to going back home. So it's, you know, there's certainly a wide mix and a wide range of people.
They're probably afraid to go ask for any type of services.
Right.
That type of circumstance. So. My switchboard disappeared here. Well, I'll tell you, Blog Talk Radio's.
Houston.
Michael?
Yes, okay, I'm still here.
Okay, that's interesting. I wonder where my switchboard Oh, well. Go ahead. Well, anyway, the other thing I was going to ask is, do cops consider these calls nuisance? I mean, how does this register in a cop when he gets a call about somebody sleeping in the doorway? Is it something they just as soon not see?
Yes, right. Absolutely. That's from my experience. I mean, I think, you know, in order to be a police officer, you certainly have to have that compassion and willingness to help all people. But, you know, depending on where you're at or how many of those calls you get, you know, a lot of those experiences are negative just because it's never an easy fix, because usually, like I said, you know, some of the homeless people do have some existing conditions that need attention, and it takes you out of service for a long time. So it certainly isn't all the time, but it certainly can be a very long process when as far as a police officer dealing with, you know, with dealing with the homeless.
What's the other social service type agency that the police are most likely to? I'm thinking of the Christian charities and things like that. You know, back in the Ice Age, as a cop, Salvation Army did lots of work with the homeless. That's still going on?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. There are a lot of great, you know, nonprofit organizations and churches that are very active. So great. Advocacy programs. You know, I belong to the Northeast, you know, Homeless Coalition here in this area. There's Columbus has a big area as well that good volunteers just to go out there and help provide services. And I think that's one of the things that I'm looking at in my research is kind of that continuum of care. In Waco, they have a thing that was actually started in San Francisco just a few years ago. It's called Project Homeless Connect, I believe. Every so often, they get together and they get, barbers, they get mental health, you know, professionals they have, people from like methadone clinics with for like needle exchanges, and just as a community, they get together and kind of try to help those that are less fortunate. I think it's a very good idea, and it's part of that continuum of care that a lot of cities don't go that and don't do that follow through with their programs. And I think I believe Dallas does this as well.
So most is like most police response calls, they what I call sort of try to fix it and don't get into long-term solutions. But on this particular problem, it sounds like the agencies that are trying to do something over the long haul are actually minimize the problem and help more people, right?
Yeah, in the long run, absolutely, yeah. I think some of these, like I said, some of this continuum of care type of programs, but it has to, everybody has to work, you know. I mean, the city really has to take the initiative to offer some job training and to provide the health care, the mental health counseling, substance abuse treatment, child care type of services, and certainly law enforcement and criminal justice is big part of something like this that really could impact and have some positive, you know, change for, you know, for the communities. I mean, we all, you know, like I said, we're all fortunate not to be on the streets, but really it could only be a paycheck away. So I think really having some of these services and going an extra mile to in a humanitarian type of you know, effort is a noble thing. And I see some of these communities really stepping up. And a lot of these volunteers are really going out and, you know, spending some of their own money or some of their own time to provide, you know, the food and clothing and, you know, different services. I talked to an eye doctor in Waco that, you know, provides free eyeglasses, you know, for the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just some of those things that, you know, are very interesting that most people don't think, you know, that... some of the things can, you know, we can some of these initiatives.
You know, I'm not able to wrap my mind around the business about the economy and industry and all that business, but it just seems like we take, and I'm struck by a comment that one of these guys made that I heard, we send so many of these jobs overseas, and one of these guys was talking about the fact that, look, he says, I can't work 8 hours. I can't do it. I can't, mentally, I can't sit and work 8 hours yet. But I could work three.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he could get training and he could stay on the job and do good work. He says, I can do it for 3 hours. I've done it. But there are no opportunities for that.
Right, yes.
I mean, we could take some of these things that we send overseas and, you know, it's almost mindless work, I'm sure, some of it.
Yes, right.
And train people to, you know, work up to maybe the eight-hour day or a half a day or something like that, and give them a purpose and some sufficiency and the whole thing. So,
yeah,
kind of, I don't understand how we can just keep sending jobs to another country. I guess somebody way up there benefits from it, but and you know, I don't want to get on Walmart's case because Walmart, you know, sells us all things that we can use. But this seems to me like we ought to be employing our own people. I don't get it.
I agree. Yes. I think with all the growth in our communities, but yet jobs are being taken away, you know. But I think it's very important that our cities, you know, really position ourselves to be ready to accommodate, you know, growth in these problems, you know, that are associated with some of this. Jobs are moving out, and you know, people have nowhere to go. So,
since you've been looking at this and talking to people and reading the literature, what are if you can think of it, what are two or three of the most remarkable cases in terms of turnaround with some of these people?
That, you know, that was one of the questions that actually over lunch I asked Dave Hogan, and I asked that, you know, do you ever see an end result? You know, and that's one of those things that has been always on my mind. I never asked that question, and they both smiled and said, absolutely. That you know, they're able to get out there and interact and be able to point a lot of these homeless people that want to help themselves into the right direction, you know, for housing or off of you know, drugs or whatever, and then they turn around and they do send letters or they do come back and say, hey, thank you for giving me, you know, help. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of the bottom line is to be able to to see that end result of somebody. It actually did take somebody off the streets. It did something positive in impacting life, a human life. I think that I was kind of, I guess, surprised, but I was happy to hear that from them, that the programs do work, and it does, you know, it does work. It does take people off the street.
I don't know the consumer's case very well, but did he sort of pull himself out of that, or did he get some assistance helping?
You know what, I'm not really sure. I think he was going to actually law school or for his master's degree at Western Reserve, and I think probably because of the financial strain, maybe that's what led him to live in a car. I'm not really sure at the time, but I know he was going to school full time as well. That's homeless.
Well, Michael, what do you see down? What do you see down the road? What are two or three things that, as you kind of coalesce all this business around the nation, what's read the literature? What are two or three things you think is going to happen with this?
Well, I think that. They said it's very hard to really pinpoint and take a look at what exactly does work and doesn't work. I think some of the grants, some of the continuing care and follow up programs currently are really working very well. Historically and currently, jobs and housing, alcohol, lack of realistic I think resources are major contributors. You know, to the homeless. I think kind of hitting some of these root problems and some of these core issues as a community or as a city can, you know, things can change. I think there's those that that will always want to be homeless that that are you really can't approach. So, you know, the problem has existed forever. It will always exist. But I think to reduce or really, you know, diminish some of the problems certainly can continue. I think we're in the headed in the right direction with some of these programs. But it takes a community. It really takes the whole city and a community with volunteers to kind of have that buy-in period of helping out and being active. It doesn't just take money. People out there. And volunteers out there, so it's you know, certainly is a very hard endeavor to really sell, but
there are
programs out there.
Because everybody I mentioned again, like the person said today, what an interesting topic. And then after that, I don't know anything about it. You know,
mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
Your dissertation, your work, and cut it up, you know, 20 different ways, and publish articles and. Even more general type magazines, you know, would get higher readership than scholarly journals, and I think that would help. That would help make the case because people just draw a blank. Oh, yeah, but like you're saying, the list of ways to help them, it's not endless. It's probably a half dozen things that people could come together around and really do something, isn't it?
Exactly. I just see some of the programs that are out there that cities are taking or counties are taking advantage of, which is a good thing, but there needs to be a follow-up. There needs to be that follow-through, and that's kind of, I think, where some of the, you know, some of the problems lay. But, yeah, absolutely. There's some great, you know, some great programs out there that, you know, that are working and could probably only strengthen and benefit. So, yeah, this is, like I said, this is a very good subject. It's something I think... you know, I think being a police officer and being an educator, you know, I've always had that, you know, passion for public service and to help, you know, to help people out. And this is, you know, that's one of my driving factors here, motivators for me. I'm really, like I said, I really feel juiced about this, and I'm ready to get, you know, get done and continue on with my research.
I'm not kidding about this at all, but I think you better get that flight bag when you get that dissertation done, because I think this is good good talk business for the television.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Very interesting stuff. I think people want to know about this, so it's great, and I commend you, and a lot of others do too, for the work you're doing. What's that look like time-wise? When do you think you'll be done?
You know what? It's just a matter of crunching numbers now, I think, and doing some polishing here. So I'm hoping within this year, at the very, you know, within the year, if not less. So I'm working diligently on it.
This is a joke, but I'm saying it doesn't seem like you've been tortured enough.
to be out that soon. Okay.
No, I have.
I have some people, and in fact, we have a common friend that's wanting to move forward, and it's been difficult, and not really his fault, I don't think. So.
Well, I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know. But you got to move forward. So.
Appreciate you coming on a second time, and I'm sure this show is going to get replayed, and we commend you for the work you're doing, and if there's anything I can do, you know, up my way to assist you on that, you be sure to let me know, and take some time off next week if you get a chance.
Hey, yeah, will do. I'm going to try to. Thank you very much again for having me, and it was certainly a pleasure. I appreciate all that you do for higher education and for criminal justice. This show is a great inspiration, a great show for all of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll meet again. Take care.
Okay, bye. Will do. Take care. Thank you. Goodbye.
Don't know when, but I know.